Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to True Crime Tuesday. This is Dr. John Stamey calling in to you from a chilly and wet Myrtle Beach, and it's just so glad to be inside with our good friends, all of them, and we're going to have a blast tonight. We've got a very special True Crime broadcast about an event that happened quite a long time ago and has remained a true, true mystery. First of all, I would like to introduce my co-host from Harlan, Kentucky, the infamous Tony Filosi. How are you doing tonight, Tony?
I'm doing wonderful, John. We've done a ton of research on this, and it's going to be a great show. Lots of good insights.
That's great, because we actually have done a scary cast on this back in the day, and it was a lot of fun. So it's going to be wonderful to catch up on what's going on here. And Darla Sailor Jackson, also from, now you are from Harlan, Kentucky, right?
That is correct, yes.
All
and
right.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here. It's going to be a blast. And none other than my partner in crime, one of my best friends in the world, the one and only Robin Haynes McCray. How are you doing tonight, Robin?
I am good. I am really excited about this show. This is a topic that really fascinates me because there's so much about it that people don't realize. And it's a much deeper thing than just, you know, what's out there. So I'm really excited about it.
That's right. It's more than just a couple of murders now. It's very exciting. And so I'm going to toss the basketball, because we're in basketball season now. I'm going to toss the big orange and black ball over to none other than Tony Filosi. Catch, buddy.
Here I go.
Did you catch?
I caught it. I'm about to make a 3-point.
Good. That's all I can.
Yes. Nothing but net, John. Nothing but net here, because Kentucky is a basketball state. But
that's right.
Anyways, what I would like to start out with is to acknowledge some people with some research that I borrowed from and got some help with. First, I'd like to thank Nancy Marietta of the Facebook group, the Sasquatch People and Other Forest Giants. Nancy is a researcher and historian of many years of various mysteries and blogger at sasquatchobservations.blogspot. Go check out her stuff. She's really, really good, and the blog is really good. Another source I used was Bedtime Stories, a 3-part YouTube series. It's really, really good. And Darla had told me about it, actually, and I found it, and I've probably spent 12 or 15 hours watching video and reading about the Dutler Pass incident, and this is one of the best video series that's out there. And also, did you know, John, that True Crime Tuesday has researchers?
I know you have
to. You do not.
Because your facts are so good.
Yes. Yes.
Thanks.
And I want to thank the True Crime Tuesday researchers, Kristen Thompson and Jenny Fugit, and we have another person maybe starting to help us, because we want to really dig in, John, and get everything we possibly can on these incidents and all the true crime cool stuff that we do. And at this point, I'm going to toss this over to the beautiful, the talented Miss Darla Sailor Jackson.
Thank you very much, Tony. So tonight we are going to be.
How do you like it? How do you like that, Josh?
How do you like it? Tonight we're going to be discussing the now infamous Dutlove Pass incident. This is an incident in which 9 members of a Russian expedition were all found dead. And I'm going to give facts only and a brief history for those of you who may have not heard about this. I'm going to say at this point in time, many have heard about this, because this is considered one of the greater mysteries of modern times. because there's just so much. There's so much to it that it's just fascinating. So here we go. The Dutlev Pass incident. In January of 1959, 10 hikers, all but one student at the Ural Polytechnic Institute in Sverdlovsk, Russia, began a hike into the Ural Mountains. They were led by Igor Dutlev. All 10 were experienced hikers. They planned a three-week trip with a return plan for February 12th. One hiker, Yuri Yudin, left early in the trip on January 28th due to a flare-up of sciatica and rheumatism. He had made it to the final leg of the trip, getting out to the Ural Mountains by sled, but had to ride back on the sled and return home. By this time, he'd already taken two trains, a bus ride, and then a sled ride with the other hikers to get to the place where they were going to begin this dangerous journey that was going to be on foot via snow skis. And they were going to be going through the mountains in the winter. He was very disappointed to leave, but this decision and his illness would actually end up saving his life. There are records of these hikers, the remaining 9 hikers, up through February 1st. That day, the hike started late and only managed to cover about 2.5 miles, which could have been the burden of excess gear because they had to now carry Yuri Yudin's gear that he was assigned to carry. This and low visibility probably slowed them down very much so. At some point, the hikers made a cache, which is a place that they were going to drop off excess gear to lighten their load before they started up the Kalat Siaki Mountain, which is now referred to as Dead Mountain, and that is what the native Mansi people of that area actually called it. They set up camp on the slope of the mountain, possibly because they did not want to lose the ground that they'd covered and because they were losing daylight. However, experienced hikers in that area said it was a very odd place to set up camp in the first place. They had, that night on February 1st, they had dinner sometime between 6 and 7 p.m. They, according to their journals and a group journal and a little mock newspaper that they were making together, they seemed to be in good spirits. And it was actually one of their birthdays the next day. That is the last documentation that was ever left by this group. They were supposed to arrive back around February 12th. When they did not, no one was immediately concerned because Igor Dutlev had told Yuri Yudin that he anticipated a later return because the weather had taken a turn for the worst. Their families, however, became very worried when they'd not heard anything from them February 20th. A search party was then sent the following day, and rescuers came across their tent a few days later, and I'm thinking it was like February 25th or 26th. Two men in the rescue team actually found their tent. The tent was the first thing to be found, and it was facing north-south, with the entrance facing south and the north part covered with about 15 to 20 centimeters of snow, and that's about 6 inches, about half a foot. The snow appeared to come from the blowing wind and not a sudden avalanche. The individual who found the tent claims that he found a flashlight on top of the tent, and this was lying in about 3 inches of snow. The tent had been cut from the inside, and the entrance was still buttoned closed. The hikers had to have escaped the tent through the cuts made on the side, most of their belongings were found still inside the tent. Next, there was footprints found leading downhill, though they were the footprints of people in socks or bare feet. There was remains of a small fire found under a cedar tree, with branches of that cedar tree broken up to 16 feet up the tree. The first body was found under the tree close to the remains of the fire, identified as one of the hikers, Gorshenko. He had burns on his head and foot, minor cuts and bruises, dried blood on his face, and a gray foam substance on his cheeks, which indicated a pulmonary edema. His cause of death was determined to be hypothermia. Just nearby was the body of Krivonoshenko, who had similar minor cuts, bruises, and was missing the tip of his nose, had burns on his hands, and a chunk of his knuckle was missing that was later found in his mouth, indicating that he bit off his own knuckle. His cause of death was determined hypothermia as well. Igor Dutlov, the leader of the group, and for whom this pass would later be named, was found about 1,000 feet up the slope back toward the tent. He had minor cuts and bruises, a missing tooth, blood on his lips, and his cause of death was determined hypothermia. His watch had stopped at 5:31 a.m. Koma Gorova, which was actually one of the two females in this group of nine, was found about 2,300 feet up the hill, so she made it further than Igor Dutlov, and she was actually the closest to the tent. She had minor cuts and bruises, a large blunt force bruise of unknown origin, and her cause of death was hypothermia. Slobodan was not found until March 5th, and he was found between Koma Gorova and Dutlov on the hill, so it appears that he was also trying to make it back toward the tent. He was wearing one boot, had similar minor wounds, and a fractured skull. The fractured skull, however, was not serious enough to cause death. His death was also determined hypothermia. It is worth mentioning that those three, heading back toward the tent, barely had clothes on, with one of the men not really having pants on, just a shirt and underwear, it seems. The last four hikers were not found until 2 months later in May when the area began to thaw. They were found in a six-foot ravine. One of them, Kolotov, the oldest, was found to have died of hypothermia. I think he was the oldest. But had a broken nose, was missing his eyes and soft tissue around them, likely from animals after his death. His clothes were found at a later time to have traces of radioactivity. He and Zoltarov, now he was the oldest, and the one non-student member and the most experienced hiker of the group, were embraced, likely trying to preserve body heat. He died from a crushed chest and had a pen and paper in hand, but was never able to write his message. Debo Brignol was nearby and died from an impact to his skull. The youngest of the group and the other female, Dubedina, died of a crushing injury to her chest. Her eyes, tongue, and soft tissue were missing. She had blood in her stomach, and radioactivity was found on her clothes. The region itself was also determined to have levels of radioactivity. So that is basically the history of this. In 2019, this incident was reopened, and it was determined by the Russian government that avalanche was their cause of death. There are several theories. There are many strange things about this, and Tony, if you want to take it from there and start discussing some of the theories that people say, let's talk about the avalanche, which
there was no avalanche,
so that's a tough one. There wasn't one.
I don't think there was an avalanche. You know, there's several theories out there. One of the two main ones are the avalanche and the downward winds. I forget the technical term for the downward winds that they talk about. I don't buy either one of them. Number one, if it was an avalanche, the tent would have been covered up and all the tracks covered up leading away from the tent. And if you look at photos of the campsite, they're just held up. The tent is just held up by skeets, and it shows the tent collapse. I said, well, the avalanche caused that. Well, I don't agree, because it would have pushed it. It would have pushed it on down the hill. Now, the reason the tent's collapsed is it's just held up by the skis, and obviously you're in the mountains of Russia, and it's going to snow some in the weeks, before they find the bodies. And I think that kind of collapsed the tent in the middle. I don't think they got out and they threw snow on it to keep it from blowing away. I mean, if you're in a windstorm, you're not going to leave your shelter. I'm going over to the wind theory. You're not going to leave your shelter and go a mile with very few clothes on and go to some trees. So I'm not a big fan of the avalanche theory at all. I can't explain the flashlight. But now let's back up and talk about why they left the tent. Okay.
Tony, this is Dr. John. I've got a brief question for you. Were mm-hmm. any other footprints found by that
no.
first team? So
no.
No,
no
other
no.
footprints
no.
other than those.
No
of the
other
eight.
Footprints. No.
Right.
No.
All right.
So you
I'm
you
staying
know,
quiet. Being a good girl.
There's no other footprints found. Now let's go back to why did they leave a perfectly good shelter, cut a hole in the side, run out the side, no clothing, very little clothing, no shoes on. They don't even try to grab a pack as they're going out. Okay, they have to be in terrible fear at that time.
At this point, Tony, let me add
mm-hmm.
one more thing. It seems,
okay.
from what I have read, that the tracks seem scattered, and then
yes.
they seem to form a line as they're
after
leaving.
Five,
and these are barefoot, sock feet footprints. Yes.
Right, about 500 meters from 100 to 500 meters away from the tent, they slow down, and it almost seems like they get back into single file going toward the tree line. Now, which is a mile away. Now, what could cause non-experienced people to be that terrified and not go out of the front of the tent? You know, what's going to cause you to cut up, leave your shelter? And have any of you guys done any winter camping or anything like that?
I have. Yes.
Okay, John, have you done any?
Not any winter camping, no, sir.
Okay. Back in the day when I was younger, I used to do a lot of classes. I took some survival classes, like Survival 101, 102, nothing, no ninja stuff. But the last class I took, it was 25 degrees, and you had one, like a thick garbage bag. It's like more like a lawn bag, and you had your fire starting material. And that was it. So you had to stay a night in the woods, and you were paired up into teams. And then the next day you finished off the exercise. Long story short, 25 degrees don't seem like it's that cold, but I promise you, if all you have is a thick meal lawn bag wrapped around and a little fire out front, and this fire wasn't very far from us, it was still cold. Now, these guys were in about 50 below or 25 below zero weather, and way more experienced than me. They were working from Class 2 to Class 3 hiking certificate, which meant that they would be master of sports and they could teach this. And these are some tough, very in shape people, very intelligent. The last part of the training exercise was you got up, they took you out, you got on the end of a pier, you jumped into a pond, you submerged three times to make sure you were really good and wet, got out, walked back to the camp area, which is about 100, 150 yards. You gathered up fire starting material in that distance, and then when you got to the camp area, you put your hands in a wash tub of cold ice water for 30 seconds to a minute, made you to simulate hypothermia. Then you had to build your fire. Long story short, that's at 25 degrees. I was really, really miserable. That was only took about 30 minutes. Now, and they had way more experience than I'll ever have. So you take these experienced people, jump up in the middle of the night, cut a hole in their only shelter, and run out into certain death, clothed, knowing they're going to die. What my question is, what could have done that? And I think whenever we kind of get a grip on that, we'll some of the other stuff will make a little bit of sense. Darla, what do you think?
I do not think it was an avalanche because, number one, the area in which they camped was not sloping near enough to cause an avalanche. Igor Dutlove would have known better. He camped in an odd place, but he didn't camp in a dangerous place. So, and there would not be a flashlight on the tent. There would not be footprints. There's a whole lot wrong with the avalanche thing, and I can't even express enough how I don't think it was an avalanche. I think it is possible that catabolic winds went through. It could lower the tent some, but not actually bring it down. I'm not certain. But it doesn't explain why they felt the need to cut
run.
These people were from Russia. They had experienced probably treacherous freezing wind before, and they would know that no matter what, stay in that tent. That was their safest place, and that was their highest rate of survival.
Yes.
Would be to have stayed in there. The huge mystery here is what made them leave. Are the natural things. It leads into weirder things.
Yes.
Foul play. Let's get that one taken care of. The Mansi tribe actually helped search for them. They were not dangerous. This was not sacred ground. This wasn't even good hunting ground. They called it Dead Mountain because there was very little wildlife there. They didn't like the mountain all that much. Some people say they considered it cursed. And all their belongings were there, money, liquor. As far as foul play with a tribe, I don't think so. Plus, there was no footprint. Some people say Russian government and military. I think if it was the military, they would have found nothing. Nothing would have been there. They would
for sure
have found
the bodies
no
have been
tent,
they would have...
no bodies, no tent, no nothing. They would have been gone. I kind of don't believe, even though the Russian military has acted strangely about the whole thing. But, you know, they tend to be very suspicious people.
They absolutely know something.
Yeah, yes. They have 100%. Acted very secretive. Yeah, secretive. They've been very secretive. I have heard that the dates, there are some documentation that indicate that the Russian government perhaps knew of this incident on February 5 through 10 versus beginning a search on February 20. There's just a lot of unusual behavior by the Russian government about this incident that that makes me curious about what they really knew.
Now, what about the Yeti? Let's get the Yeti out of the way.
Let's get the Yeti out of the way.
He's going back to Yetiville.
He's going back to the Himalayas real quick because the group was making a mock newspaper, and that's kind of how the Yeti came up. There was a mock newspaper they were making for fun, and they put that they now believed in the existence of the Yeti. It was a joke. Also, I think that many of them could have fought a Yeti. I'll be honest with you. One of them fought a grizzly in one. These were some tough people. They would have fought a Yeti. They wouldn't leave their campsite. They would have fought for their campsite. If it were something like this, there were no weird tracks. There is a strange picture. They call it Frame 17, where a lot of people want to believe that that is a Bigfoot
that
picture.
That is not
it
a
is
Bigfoot.
A human. No, if
right.
you look at the, look at the trees.
Absolutely
look at the
trees. Not a Yeti.
This is a bundled up, fit man. Not huge. This is it does not have the build of any sort of primate animal. I totally agree. It's a human being. They were taking pictures of some of the people in the group. Had they encountered that, don't you believe that their journals would have been full of Yeti information? We saw something. We didn't know what it was. We saw this. None of that. I think we can let Yeti go.
There were Yeti there.
It did, but they had nothing to do with what went on.
And see another thing about the Yeti, okay? He would have torn. He just wouldn't have. First, they'd been Prince. Second, he would have torn. If he was going to be aggressive, he would have torn the tent. He just went in. He torn the side out and started snagging people out. Second, whenever they ran, they're not going to outrun a Yeti half naked. You know, running down the hill.
You can't run fast enough.
So he's going to catch him. He's going to catch him from behind, rip him up. Move to the next, and they would have been mangled bodies strewn all the way to the tree line. So, I don't think the Yeti is a possibility. But, and some say the Russian military would drop parachute bombs in and things like that. And the infrasound, I'm not buying the infrasound because maybe on one or two people it would have had the same effect on, but it's not going to have the same effect on 9 people at the same time, and it's not going to affect them for a mile, I wouldn't think. You know, why did they not stop at some point and turn around and go, well, you know, wow, there's nothing really after us, or that thing is gone. Let's go back and get warm. Let's go grab our gear. You know, so they were really fearful of that something was either hovering or. I mean, something had to keep them away from that site. So let's go. Do you know, besides the UFO one, which I'm about to toss out there, do you know of any more, Donna?
I'm thinking that UFO is one, and that would probably be the next one to discuss. There have been others, experimentation. Someone suggested, and this was like on a blog or a group, could drugs have been involved? Could they have been drugged? Could one of them, possibly the one that survived and went back, could he have put drugs in their food? Different things like that. UFO is nearly valid. In my opinion, there were some odd things that happened. An expedition somewhat near them claimed to have seen light, and the tops of the trees were burned as well.
Let me interject. Out of all of the things we've talked about, I think it was a Manzi tribesman that saw strange lights and they said that wasn't unusual for that mount. Now, that's the only known. You know, I mean, we go into talking about the bodies or states of decay and this, that, and the, this, that, and the other. And we'll talk about that in a second. But, and I'm not saying it is a UFO. I'm not saying it is not a UFO. But out of all of the things, there was some sort of craft that was saw by other people in that direction. Okay, that's the only known fact that we have. Everything else is we're trying to prove an unknown with an unknown. Okay? So we're
yes.
So to me, you know, if you have a UFO, and I'm not saying some sort of craft, whether it's an experimental Russian craft, whether it's a UFO, you know, whatever it is, if it's out front, you're probably not going to go out there. And you probably will cut up, and you're going to think you're going to die in a few seconds. So you may, the only reason you're going to leave that shelter is if you think that your death is imminent if you stay where you're at. Okay, go ahead.
The people worked with radioactive, with some radioactivity at their Polytechnic Institute, but they showed radioactivity. And according to some reports, the area showed radioactivity.
Mm-hmm.
And
it
then
did.
There is an unconfirmed report that Igor Dutlov's mother claimed he had gray hair. Radioactivity.
When he died.
I think Tony, when she saw his dead body, and that he clearly in photographs had brown hair, she claimed his hair was a different color and he didn't look like the same person. I'm thinking radio. I think Tony has been really researched that the most, and I think you determined that fright can't do it immediately. That
no.
Radioactivity would be more of an explanation even for that. And then we're not even talking about tongues being gone, biting,
which are similar to cattle mutilations.
Yes.
And the amount of blood in her stomach suggested, they didn't say conclusively, that she may have been alive. Whenever we don't know that she didn't bite her own tongue. You know, I'm not saying an alien cut her tongue off, but they suggested that she may be alive while the tongue was removed.
The logical explanations don't work with or correlate with the very unusual injuries these people had. They underwent some sort of very severe trauma. Even the ones not in the ravine had broken bones, fractured skulls. They went through something. Wind could not have caused that.
Now, what I think happened, you know, is a possibility. Okay, there's something that ran them out of the tent. We know there was light sighted. So we'll say that for sake of argument, it was some sort of craft. Okay? They've never seen anything like this before. It terrifies them. They're out the side, and they don't, I mean, they're going so fast they don't even try to grab a pack or nothing. They mean, just they think they're going to die just in a few minutes. But once they made it to the tree line, and see, when they seen whatever it was wasn't following them, I think that's when they slowed down, and they kind of got single file, and they got their, because they're very disciplined, you know. So once they see it wasn't, they got the single file, and they knew to go to the tree line because that's going to be some sort of shelter because they're not going back to that camp at this point. Now, when they get down to the camp, you know, we have the branches that are cut off. I think that's more to do with a fire. I do think somebody did climb a tree to see if whatever it was still around the camp. Now, then you get into some of the autopsy reports, and it talks about some of them have injuries that are very similar to a fist fight. Okay? the people fighting. I think that they got down into the tree line. Dutlove wanted to go back, and the other guys are saying, no, man, we can't. We're going to, you know, if we go back up, we're going to die. And they argue. I think some of the injuries could have been from a physical altercation between them, because obviously the two groups split. You had a group that stayed at the trees and a group that went back. And, you know, some of the people will say that, well, three people went back to, you know, to grab gear. Well, or not very well clothed. And, you know, I don't know how it's going to take to cover a mile up, gather the gear and a mile back. But are they going to carry all nine backpacks? Are they going to carry all nine sets of boots? Well, they've been three of them, so they've been six extra sets of boots. They would all went. So I think there was some sort of altercation or disagreement there, and that's the reason you had only three of them go back. So that's my thoughts on how some of the injuries occurred.
One thing I wanted to add, the young man found dead under the tree, he was the largest of the group, and it seems mm-hmm. that he was the one who climbed the tree, because there was skin fragments found up in the tree that was his. So he did climb the tree. Most people say he either wanted to see the tent, but the most logical explanation is he was trying to break off
firewood
to build that
right.
fire that was that
right.
truly built right below that cedar tree.
Yes. Now the burnt the tops of those trees. Now were the bodies found under where the tops of the trees were burned? Were they the same trees?
The same forest area. Yes.
Okay.
Now the exact same trees. I don't know.
Now, this is a question, I should know. I tried to find the answer. I couldn't, because I didn't think about it till about 30 minutes before the show. But maybe you guys can help me. Have there been instances where that UFOs or some sort of craft have singed or burned the top of trees as they're hovering over them?
100% yes. I've actually had in parts of my yard where we've had crafts come down, I've had the grass burnt. But, yes, there has been countless reports of the treetops being burnt, as well as the radioactive residue.
So there's a second known. There's a second known. The first known is we had witnesses, you know, saw lights. The second known is that this can happen. Now, my question is, you know, they checked a lot of things for radioactivity, and they saw the tops of the trees burn. Did they check the trees and not tell anybody, or they just didn't think about it, or?
I think it was
why didn't they not? There we go.
There was a great deal of information that happened. I actually found out about it only because of contacts that I had, and a lot of things that happened that were never put in front of the public, down to the paperwork that they still have locked away, you know, under the assumption of an unsolved case, there has been documentation stolen out of that.
Now, also, what wasn't, and Darla, you may can help me with this, or Robin or John, wasn't one of the officials, investigative officials, told by the military to definitely, whatever he did, don't put any unknown flying craft or UFO to toss that out.
I had heard that. I'm not going to swear that it's true because I heard it secondhand, but I had heard that, yes. My other understanding is not only that, but certain people were told that is, you know, from the get-go, this was an avalanche. This is how we're leaving it.
Right. Well,
some didn't follow that thought, but they were shot down. This was never supposed to have gone on this long.
One other thing about the man that you're referring to, Tony. after I have read and heard that after he investigated this, after he was informed not to say anything about any unusual craft, when he left that office, he became nearly obsessed with the study of UFOs, and he actually dedicated the rest of his life to ufology.
That's
fantastic.
I read that before. Mm-hmm. So now we're putting a case together, and I know that there'll be a lot of other folks that will say y'all didn't spend 10 years to looking at this, but we have to deal with what we have. This is, we're not saying that it happened this way. We're just saying this is a possible solution. But we're dealing with unknown lights, okay. We're dealing with people that cut out of the side of a tent because something was hovering, or it had to be hovering because there were no footprints in front of the tent. We have the tops of trees burned, and we have radiation. Okay, so we're starting to build a circumstantial case, in my opinion, and you know, there's far better researchers out there than I'll ever be that may have this figured out, but I'm leaning more toward there was some that was the unknown that terrified them. So, any more thoughts on the UFO possibility before we get into the bodies and then turn it over to Robin and John?
No, I think we're good. I think that's it.
Yeah, I would rather wait until John and I talk to go in more with that.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's talk about the condition of the bodies. I think a lot of that, you know, can be explained. Some of it cannot, especially the crushed ribs. But then that goes back to they said that was had to be something like a car wreck or some sort of explosion type thing to do that much damage.
That is correct, and they say that the people in the ravine, that it's possible their dugout that they created with snow to try to save themselves collapsed on them. However, the first female to die was never anywhere near that area, and she, too, had blunt force trauma to her chest, and one of the men had a fractured skull. So they were nowhere near there, yet they sustained similar injuries that indicated that they were hit with some a pretty great force. And yes, the autopsy, the medical examiner doing this said that it was similar to that of a car crash.
Mm.
So that's very odd.
I want you, we get to the point at that towards the end, please remind me of that situation, if you would. Like you said, I want to wait and do most of my comments at the end, but I don't want to forget to bring that up.
Okay.
Well,
I just know I'll forget.
you know, that's about all that I have. Darla, do you have anything else before we turn it over to Robin and John? Any observations,
you know,
thoughts?
I think that we've covered it. You know, there have been a few other, and I'm going to say theories that really don't really pan out enough to thoroughly discuss them, like a frequency of noise caused by the wind that created.
That
was one thing. A fight amongst themselves because the first female to die, Zena, had dated one male and then another. However, I have learned that her boyfriend broke up with her, and then she started dating Igor Dutlov. So there was no love triangle there. They seemed to very much have been getting along at least before they went to bed that night.
And the autopsy stated on her that she was not sexually active at the time.
Yes.
Let's hit on the wind. What was the technical term of it? Catabolic
wind.
Catabolic wind. Okay, that's where that the wind drop. It's a downward dropping wind. And again, let's go back to the photographs. Whenever they found the tent, okay, if you know if they were afraid that this, that there was a tornado happening or a giant wind happening, it was going to blow them off the slope, and they had to run to the tree line. I'm not buying that. I mean, is the wind picking up? If they did think they had to move, they would have got their pack. They would have picked the tent up, and they would have. And I know it comes on suddenly. They would have moved that way, in my opinion. Also, if you look at the photographs, the thing is not twisted. You know, if it was blowing one direction or the other, that type of heavy wind, it's going to wrap the tent around. It's going to wad it up. Or if the snow is in the middle, if the snow collapsed on top of it, it'll at least be like a teardrop. So I'm not buying the wind theory. So if you don't have anything else, Darla, I'll toss this over to Robin and John. Robin, would you?
Well, I'm going to let John go first because
I
got
quite
a few things.
John.
No, you're
right.
Fine. I just want to make sure he gets
it. I got
him back.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, John. I'm so sorry, John. I forgot.
No, that's all right. There's something that I'm really curious about. When the tents were torn, apparently by a knife or something sharp, were they torn from the inside out or from the outside
yeah.
right.
in?
Inside.
Yeah,
inside out. Proven. It was proven.
So they were getting out. So now either
they were before they broke out. They did that before they broke out. They had been watching whatever was going on.
That's
and then
what
when
I
they
believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when they took off, that's when they put their hole in some of the cuts and just ripped it open to get out quickly.
Right. So my question is, or my comment is this. Either something happened externally to terrify them to get out so quickly that they didn't care to get out, you know, the button upside. Or something occurred inside of the tent. Something got ginned up. Whether it was by aliens or whatever, and they had to rip to get out that fast, and that seems to be, you know, what I can see is that something might have gotten ginned up inside of the tent. I mean, because these folks with advanced technology, they can do all kinds of stuff that we can't, and they could have ginned up images or whatever, and. These folks could have just ripped and gotten out. I mean, that actually seems like the most reasonable thing is that something frightened them inside of the tent, not from outside. Because if something's right out above you, like 20 feet above you, making all kinds of racket, you're gonna hunker down inside your tent. So I think something must have gotten ginned up somehow. Inside all the tents, and then they got out. What happened to him next?
Yeah.
We don't know. But that's kind of what I see. Do what?
Was there lights? Do you think?
I see an image. Here's what I see. I see an image inside the tent, and them just trying to get the hell out of there. And that's what I see. And they were wanted to be forced out of their tents almost naked, and then they can do anything they want to them. I mean, I think they were scared out. They were scared from inside out, and then they were just picked up. They were rounded up by aliens, and that's it. That's what I think. And I can kind of see that happening. Okay, Robin? First of all, does that even seem reasonable? And number two, what do you think?
I absolutely agree with you. And the reason I do is because whether it's something of the alien origin, up in the Ural Mountains, and probably in other mountains as well, it's not going to be, you know, just a Ural Mountain thing. But up in the mountains, there are various cryptids there. There are not just Bigfoot. There are not just dogmen. There are other things there that are just unbelievable that people can't even comprehend. somebody that I know very, very well has already had an experience with these things. Now, to begin with, we already know the ETs create cryptids and hybrids and drop them here. So God only knows what's running around. But basically, these things all do telekinesis. And I've known that for several years, many, many years. But they are all, not only do they mind speak, they're telekinetic, which means they don't have to be in the tent to be moving things around inside the tent. Now, I myself have been talking to one of the victims today and was given some information there. But this had been going on for 3 days prior, the night that they took off. They had been watched, they had been followed, and that's why the slits were made in the tent. They were taking shifts to watch out around because of the concern of what was following them. A lot of things went on that night, not just that. But I believe that Don is very correct in that assumption. I think that something was being moved around in the tent, something was going on through the telekinesis process, and it terrified them on top of what the woman told me that went on that night. There was, to begin with, there's not just one answer. You have to look at it in layers because there's an awful lot of things that went on there that was basically the perfect storm.
That makes a lot of sense.
One thing that I would like to add to that, I'm kind of agreeing with maybe they may have had some concern because the two men that were found in the ravine actually embracing to keep warm, they had the most clothing. They were the only ones that had boots on, and it seemed as if perhaps they were standing outside keeping watch at the time or was kind of on more of an alert than the others because they seemed more prepared.
Well, from what this woman told me today, they were all inside the tent. I think they had the boots and stuff on only because they were on guard. They were at times going outside and checking things over, which is why there was a flashlight on the top of the tent.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go
out.
That
would explain the flashlight.
Yeah.
Yep.
So they would go out. They would, you know, look around. They'd check and make sure. Then they'd go back in. But those holes they had cut 3 days prior at various times to keep an eye on what was going outside because it would get so cold at night. That way they could look out. There was at least two people, if not more, on guard at all times.
That would also explain
why that Igor Dutlov, he had made a stove and actually carried it on his back and had used it, but had ceased using it. So in this bitter cold, he had not set up his stove and kept the tent warm, but he couldn't have if there had been slits in the tent because the heat would have just escaped. It would have been really for no reason to have done that. So that kind of explains why he hadn't set the stove up. It did not seem to have been used very much.
No, and they also, I think, from what I'm getting, they didn't want that stove going. They were trying to do what they were going to do and get back home. And with things watching and the things that were going on that night, which I will get into more, but they didn't want that stove going on. You know, if that stove is going on, it's a beacon. It's easy to find where they're at, whether it be from the smoke, you know, the redness from the fire, whatever. And that was not something I think that they really wanted at that time.
Interesting.
But that's my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And you were going to expand on their injuries, perhaps?
I'm trying to remember what I wanted to talk to you about because there's so many things in this case that I really want to say. But I don't want to cut anybody off or take too much time where, you know, nobody else can talk. When it comes to those injuries, first off, there has been a program that has been going on for hundreds of years with the ETs where they do these cattle mutilations. It is not unheard of that they also did those kind of mutilations on people. So a lot of the things
that are now coming out and they're saying, oh, this is a plausible reason. You know, it was the wildlife. It was the avalanche. It was this. It was this. Are a very convenient cover-up. And the government is fantastic at it. But it's still a cover-up. Doesn't make it true. And, you know, you're talking about, is it possible the animals did it? Yeah. There were no animal tracks anywhere around there. I mean, let's keep that in mind. Or the fact that it was so cold, very little wildlife was out and about on the side of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is always the possibility that, you know, predators would have come and done that. But if that were the case, I would also think they would try to take the flesh. They would not take just the eyes and not just the tongue. They would also, there would be signs of them chewing on the flesh because that would have been an easier part to do. They would have gone, you know, to the softer skin rather than try to pull an eye out of a socket or a tongue out of a mouth. They would have just started on the actual flesh. That wasn't done. I don't think I've seen anything where it said that that had happened.
No. No, none of that. So, none of that had happened.
So for me, I don't buy the predation. I just don't. Is it possible? Absolutely. I'm not going to say it's not. Do I think it's likely? No, I do not. I think that there's layers and layers of cover up to this. Okay. They left. Before I start, John, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, not this time. Thank you.
Okay. When they left, obviously we know that the one gentleman didn't go due to illness. And they got up there. They were very well of the Manzies. Now, the Manzies had a very bad reputation of anybody going through their territory, they would kill. In this case, they had nothing to do with this. They were terrified of that mountain like everybody else was. They had seen Yeti on there. They were all over that mountain. Did they do this? No, they didn't. But that doesn't mean they weren't there. Okay? And I'm going to explain why I say that. A lot of this paranormal stuff, it all hangs together, even if they don't work together. They all seem to show up at the same time to see what the other one's doing. And so, you know, the Manzies were one of the first things they went to when this happened. They had nothing to do with it. They wanted nothing to do with it. And like you had said, you know, they did help to try to find the bodies. They had had problems with Yetis there, they had said. But they. The other thing is, even if it was them, it doesn't make sense on their end because this many people died, but this is a tribe of people that want to be left alone. They don't want people coming to them. They wanted to stay isolated. They wanted to be cut off from everybody. And for that many people to go missing, they know that's going to bring in the authorities and people are going to be all over that mountain. So from their perspective, it would have been something that they would not have done because there was too many people involved. One person they might be able to get rid of and, that, you know, and nobody's going to think anything about it. A group of college students, that's not going to happen. There's going to be people all over the mountain. They're going to be looking for them. That kind of attention is not something that tribe of people would want.
Right. Now, guys, I hate to cut you short. We're coming down to the end of this awesome show. At some point, we'll have to do a part two. But at this time, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. John Stamey to take us out of here.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. We have explored a very perplexing problem, and I think we've come closer to the truth. It took a little intuition from Robin, maybe a little bit from me, and a ton of research from the crew with Darla and Tony and their associates. They've done a great job, and yes, Tony, I think maybe in a month or so, after we let this settle just a little bit, we might want to revisit this because, you know, we might come up with some different conclusions. But until that time, it's been great. And thank you, Tony. Thank you, Darla. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
And we're going to hope that it'll get warmer and sunnier here in Myrtle Beach and all over the South. You guys had some snow, I think, last night, didn't you, Tony?
We did. We just had a couple inches. It wasn't too bad, But I'm afraid with the cold temperatures and the thawing today, we're going to have a lot of ice tomorrow. But I think everything will be fine.
Well, good. Robin, you stay warm there in the Midlands of South Carolina. Darla and Tony, have a great one. We'll see everybody next week on the one, the only True Crime Tuesday.
And we appreciate everybody for listening. And See you guys next week.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya. Bye-bye.